10-780 in the matter of JM, adjudicated delinquent child. For the appellant, Ms. Powell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Mr. Rowland, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The only thing the age-based distinctions in 2152-83 accomplish is to require juvenile courts to place children on the registry who should not be there. Including children on the registry who are not a risk to public safety dilutes the purpose of the registry. And so discretionary registrants, that is, kids who were 14 or 15 at the time of their offense, will be ordered to register if the court finds this appropriate. But children who were 16 or 17 at the time of their offense will be ordered to register only based on their age and not any other factors. Now, in crafting 2152-83, the General Assembly took the drastic step of stripping juvenile courts of discretion to make decisions as to whether a child should be registered. Now, this law addresses high school kids, children who were 14, 15, 16, and 17 at the time they committed their offense. But this law requires courts to treat sophomores drastically differently than it treats juniors without any justification.
Counsel, I think the real heart of the matter is whether, in fact, there is a obvious and assumed difference between a child who is 13 and one who is 16, or one who is 14 and 15. And as I gather your argument, you're saying essentially a 13-year-old and a 16-year-old are the same. No developmental difference, no basis at all in which to make a distinction.
Well, we know that this state is the only state that does this, that makes distinctions under the age of 18. And we also know that Roper and Graham, the United States Supreme Court, addressed all children under 18. The research also addressed adolescents. And so the research that studies juvenile sex offenders addresses children who were 13 through 17. So there really is no basis to treat children under 18 differently based on their age.
Now we have there are some other criminal statutes that treat children differently based on their age as well. There's like for bind over, for example, I think age 14 becomes a key factor. So if we were to agree with your argument, that would that then implicate all these other age-based statutes that apply to juveniles?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is SYO and bindover are good examples of age-based distinctions. First of all, both of those address punishment. Secondly, both of those require the court to consider age plus other factors like the charged offense, like other enhancement factors of violence. This is the only instance where the General Assembly has told courts that they have to impose a sanction based solely on age and not with consideration to any other factors. And remember, normally children who are subject to juvenile court jurisdiction, and that doesn't include, you know, SYO because they're not pure it's juvenile, but it involves adult punishment, and that's not bind over because that takes children out of the juvenile system. Normally, children who are in the juvenile system are held accountable or punished only until 21. Again, this is a unique situation where the General Assembly has imposed a sanction that that takes the child beyond normal juvenile court jurisdiction.
Counsel, if you had, or the statute incorporated the ability for the judge to have a hearing to determine, in other words, it was discretionary with 16 and 17-year-olds, we wouldn't be here, correct?
We would not be here.
And that's really the flaw in your mind of this system is that, you know, juveniles get a hearing to determine whether they should be bound over, even if they're 14, that there was no hearing in this case that would, you know, account for the imposition of what is termed an adult registration requirement. This is not what the statute is doing is imposing an adult registration requirement on a 16 or 17-year-old, correct?
As much as I would love to agree with you, because I think the effect is very adult-like, because it does stretch into the child's adulthood, it's unfair to say that this is an adult sanction. Juvenile registration is different. Children on the juvenile registry are not on the public registry. Children are not subject to residency restrictions. So it's not exactly like an adult sanction, as much as I would like to agree with you. However, it's very close. The public is certainly able to walk into a sheriff's office. Now, they can't access it on the web like they can on eSORN for adults, but they can walk into a sheriff's department and get a list of children and then copy the list and put it in mailboxes and do whatever they want. It's very close to an adult sanction. This step of registering, and I also don't want to lead the court to believe that there's no hearing. There is a hearing to determine a child's tier. But at that hearing, and in the first step of that hearing, the court has no power when the child is 16 or 17 at the time he commits his offense. And so I want to be clear, this is a two...
But later on, if the imposition of the requirement is there, the child can petition the court to be relieved of that responsibility, correct?
Yeah, well, there are two. Petition, yes. That comes a little bit later. There is an automatic hearing at the end of disposition, which has generally been interpreted to be at the end of parole, so once a child's released from parole. Child is not does not need to ask for that hearing. It's supposed to happen in every instance. The problem, however, with that stage of this that step is that, like in 2152-83, that mandatory hearing pursuant to 2152-84, the court has little power with regard to children who were 16 and 17 at the time they committed their offense if they are already a Tier 1. If those children are already a Tier 1 and have been deemed to be the lowest level offender, then at that mandatory hearing, the court can't do anything because the court also is just required to keep that registration in place. That's another age-based distinction. So when the state suggests that the ability to be relieved of registration later absolves this problem, it really doesn't. It continues to that next step covered by 2152-84. Then once the child is 3 years out, he or she can ask for a new hearing to then be relieved of his or her responsibilities.
Should we be looking at this legislation in terms of a rational basis of the General Assembly?
Yes.
And wouldn't the state offer that protection of the public would be a rational basis for this kind of legislation?
Absolutely. And protecting the public is a laudable goal. However, there are a few problems with this, and I think the court needs to consider the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors when looking at this part of it. Now, the statute must be rational, but it also must be legitimate. And so while protecting the public may be rational, the question is whether over-including children who aren't dangerous on the registry is rational. Secondly, the purpose clause of 2950-01A6, that's silly that I didn't think of that, actually it's in B, suggests that the effect of this cannot be punitive. So the public must be protected, but the process cannot be punitive. And so if the Kennedy-Mendoza factors show us that maybe it's so punitive for these kids, especially with these age-based distinctions, then it's not legitimate because it's punitive. Now, if those factors lead this court to believe, as this court discussed in Bodike and Shinaki, that it's so close to the line, then it still can't be legitimate. So again, under the rational basis test, the law must be rational and legitimate. This can't pass muster even under that test because it's not rational. Children who commit sex offenses are less likely than any other group of offenders to recidivate. That means that 90 to 96% of kids will never commit another sex offense. Children also, we know, develop at different ages, reach different developmental milestones at different ages. And so in a high school, we have children who are developing at all different ages. Research tells us that children sort of mold their sexual behavior to their developmental maturity level. And they also are more amenable to treatment, more responsive, more able to understand empathy as they age. And so that means, again, that when a court is stripped of its discretion, it doesn't have the ability to make these decisions amongst these differently aged children.
Well, as your contention is that the same age child will have a different development, or that generally children will have a different development from 13 14, 15, 16, that each one of those will be a bit different?
I think that it's obvious to any of us who have been around children that children develop at wildly different rates. I know this court considered DB about a month ago, and that was a 12-year-old child who was very big, very mature, and had very sexualized behavior. That child will never have to register for the offense that the prosecutor thought he committed. And so I think that this, it really doesn't make sense. Juvenile courts historically—
Does an exception now and then throughout the general plan for on a rational basis? And I assume there's probably no evidence in this record about developmental stages of children.
There isn't. I mean, this court can look to the U.S. Supreme Court cases in Roper and Graham for that. But this, again, this must be legitimate. And this looks a lot like punishment when it shakes out and a child is 38 years old and still registering. That certainly means that this is not legitimate, and it can't pass rational basis review on that score. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowland.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Doug Rowland. I'm the Assistant County Prosecutor for Wyandotte County, Ohio. Justin Messmer was 16 at the time that he committed the offense of gross sexual imposition. And the victim of the offense was under the age of 13. He admitted to this offense on January 9th of 2008, which was approximately 9 days after Senate Bill 10 was enacted, Your Honor. The correct standard of review for a claim of equal protection in the case is a rational basis claim. The question, I guess, is whether treating 16-year-olds different from 14, 13-year-olds is a violation of Mr. Messmer's equal protection. I'd like to be clear that Senate Bill 10 didn't start with this and didn't begin this classification between 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 16 and 17-year-olds. This was the case with the adoption of Megan's Law. Since 2002, 14 and 15-year-old offenders, or with them, the court would have discretion as to whether or not they would be required to register as sex offenders. The court, with Senate Bill 10, continued that, however, created this tier-based classification, wherein if they committed a certain tier or a certain offense that fell within the tier, in this case a Tier 2 offense for gross sexual imposition.
So under Megan's Law, the 15 and 16-year-olds were automatically required to register, and there was no discretion with the judge as well?
No. With the 14 and 15-year-olds who previously committed a prior sex offense, they were required to register under the old Megan's Law. If they were 14 or 15 years old and they had no prior sex offenses, then it was discretionary with the court.
What about 16 and 17-year-olds under Megan's Law?
It was required. It was required that they register.
Even for first-time offenders?
Yes, Your Honor. That's my understanding.
And Mr. Rowland, do you dispute opposing counsel's statement that Ohio is the only one that has this type of classification, where the distinction is made between the two sets of adolescents?
I can't dispute that because I'm not aware of any states that fall in line with Ohio on that issue, Your Honor. The discretion, or the lack of discretion, that we had under the Megan's Law, I guess, or in how we classify these juvenile offender registrants is a little bit different under Senate Bill 10, in that under the old system, the court would first determine whether or not the juvenile was a sexual predator. And if the juvenile wasn't a sexual predator, then it went back to the habitual sex offender. If it wasn't the habitual sex offender, then it went back to the juvenile offender registrant, which is where Justin probably would have fell under the old classification. Under the new classification, under Senate Bill 10, because it's a Tier 2 offense, if following the Third Appellate District Court, he would be a Tier 2 offender, meaning he would have 20 years to register versus the 10 years to register that he would have under
but
the old
Senate
Megan's
Bill 10
law.
Was not it was not in place when he committed the crime, correct?
That's correct. When he committed the crime, that's correct.
Do Do we have a retroactivity issue here as well with him, and or is that, has that been separated out and held for the other matters?
I think it's similar to the other matters, Your Honor. When he committed the offense, when the offense was committed in 2007, Senate Bill 10, or Megan's Law, would have applied to that offense. But after then, after he was adjudicated, Senate Bill 10 was in effect. And I believe that Senate Bill 10 requires any sex offense that was committed after January 1st of 2002 to fall within the scope of the new law, of the new legislation.
So even if we were determined as to this person, if we find that there is a retroactivity issue, anyone getting convicted after the date of the Adam Walsh Act, we still have that issue that we are here on right now.
I would hope that the court could craft an opinion that would encompass this, that would determine this or make this determination, maybe if for no other reason, because, I mean, appellate courts are struggling with this. They're split decisions, and any guidance would be useful. But I would think that because Senate Bill 10 was and does apply to this case, even though the offense occurred prior to Senate Bill 10, that the court could craft an opinion covering this as well, and that would be binding upon future cases.
The prosecutor or the defense attorney talks about the fact that there's no discretion, or the discretion is much more limited. Can you compare the discretion under the Adam Walsh Act to the Megan's Law?
Under the Adam Walsh Act, again, according to the Third District, there is no discretion with respect to what tier to place the child in, okay? It's offense-based in terms of certain offenses are tier one, certain offenses are tier two, certain offenses are tier three. Under the old act, again, he probably would have been the lesser or the sexually oriented offender versus a habitual or a 20-year reporting period. So I hope that answered your question. The General Assembly found specifically that certain offenders pose more of a risk to the community than others. And when we talk about who these offenders are, it specifically stated even after being released from jail or detention. So that provision obviously is applying to juveniles as well as adults in the 2950 in revised code provision. But the General Assembly found that if this information's out there, people are in a better position to protect both themselves and their families.
Wouldn't they have to go to the Sheriff's Department to order to find this out?
Yes, they would.
So it's really not the best form of notice to the public to shelter the juvenile at 16 and 17 by not having it on the website of the sheriff, et cetera.
Well, I think that's a balance. You know, obviously, these juveniles, unless you fall within a very specific category, are not placed on internet or community notification.
And what's kind of doesn't make sense to me, is that you want to require the registration in a 16 or 17 year old, yet you want to hide that information and not make it as readily available to the same public that you are seeking to protect. So I don't know how you can have it both ways as the state, how you can say it's okay to make these adolescents register with the sheriff, but the information can't be shared because they're juveniles. How does that work? That's kind of contradictory.
Well, I think that it can be shared. It's still public record.
Only if someone goes to seek it out, but that's not the case of adult sex offenders, correct?
Correct.
You can put in your address and up pops every person on the registry within X amount of miles or whatever of your particular resident. You couldn't do that with these adolescents would not be shown if that was the case, correct?
That's correct. They would not appear on the
internet. So what's the purpose of not putting the adolescents on the registry that is most readily available to the citizen who the state is claiming to protect?
Well, I think that would further expose the juvenile, and that would further subject the juvenile to, I guess, individuals who could go on and punch that information in and find that information. It would be, but here's, I guess if I could have an example.
Let me ask you another question then. When this juvenile becomes an adult, then is his registration information on the adult system?
No, Your Honor.
So he's a 35-year-old sex offender, and because he committed the crime when he was a juvenile, that information is not on the big website. You got to go to the sheriff to determine if JM is a sexual offender. All right, what's the rationale behind something like that?
I guess I can answer that question, hopefully, in this way. The information is available to someone who lives or moves to a community that says, hey, I want to know what sex offenders live in my area. And at least that tool is out there. At least that tool is there for someone to call the sheriff and say, well, Justin M. is a sex offender, but he's not on the registry because it was committed when he was an adult or when he was a child. So he's not on the registry, but he has been convicted of a sex offense, and he has a duty to register periodically with the sheriff's department. I guess another example, you know, if someone moves into a community or if someone wants to have a babysitter, for instance, at least the information, if the child was previously convicted of a sex offense, that available can be obtained. And I think it strikes a balance in trying to protect the juvenile and then also be able to make that information be out there at least in some fashion.
So you think the non-registry the non-dissemination of the information on the sheriff's website is a protective measure for the juvenile?
I can't say that that's what
so
the intent was behind
the
it.
The state is seeking to protect these juveniles. This is a form of protection.
Let me be clear. As far as I'm concerned, I think that Ms. Powell in the public defender's office would take greater issue with this information being available on a website than I would representing the state of Ohio. I don't necessarily think that that's a bad idea, but I don't know that that information was ever allowed to be placed on under Megan's Law or any sex offender registration, was allowed to be placed on the internet.
Which further indicates that the state is a little bit schizophrenic here. They want to protect a juvenile. You know, we can't let the public have all the information because we are going to attach some of the tenets of the juvenile justice system to these youngsters, but we're still going to peg them with this reporting requirement until their adulthood.
Yes, Your Honor, potentially until their adulthood, but I think that's where there's a protection that's also built in there for juveniles in that juveniles are subject to a mandatory hearing after their disposition to come back and review the effectiveness of treatment and whether or not to reduce the tier or the classification. But then it goes one step further, and 3 years after that, the juvenile can petition the court to come back and relieve them of their duties or obligations to register as a sex offender.
And that's a distinction that's available to them no matter whether they're 14 or 16 when they're assigned?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any age that they're found to be in a sexual classification for reporting, they have the ability to come back?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that continues.
But 14 and 15-year-olds, the initial classification or requirement for registration is discretionary with the judge.
That's correct.
So there could be a 15-year-old that commits the same crime as a 16-year-old, and the judge has a discretionary hearing and decides not to make the 15-year-old register, but for the same crime, same circumstances, that 16-year-old, the judge would have no discretion in and would have to require the registration.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the only difference is, could be as little as a month in the difference of their ages.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And to further address that, that's true throughout the juvenile code. The juvenile code itself has age-based classifications consistently throughout it. And again, that's not something that's changed by Senate Bill 10.
No.
Your Honor, it's society in general holds 16 and 17-year-olds and treats them differently from younger people. 16 and 17-year-olds are on the brink of adulthood.
What is the rational basis for the state doing that?
The rational basis is for the protection of the public, Your Honor.
Anything beyond that?
No.
Ms. Powell argues that that isn't rational to do that, to cut this distinction.
Ms. Powell, she relies on research of juvenile sex offenders. I think the common thread that she would even agree with is that there's very little that's known. There isn't a whole lot of research out there in that area.
Well, if there's not a whole lot of research, what did the legislature base this distinction on?
Your Honor, again, I think it meshes very well with the juvenile code in general, with the age-based classifications, and holding those individuals and those juveniles that are closer to adulthood responsible for their actions. And again, these are the
well,
children
is,
that
is there a study that shows that 16-year-olds are more likely to recidivate than 15-year-olds?
There is no study that I'm aware of that says that. There is a study that has concluded that typically juvenile offenders do not pose a risk to adults.
Juvenile offenders, that's a category, right?
That's correct.
Not 14-year-old, 15-year-olds don't do this, or 16 or 17-year-olds or 13-year-olds. It's juveniles collectively.
But, Your Honor, I was going to continue. Is the risk increases slightly upon adults after the child reaches the age of 16. So that's the only research that I'm aware of that specifically cites a slight increase in, I guess, potential harm to adults.
Counsel, is the statute unconstitutional because the legislature drew a line without relying on scientific research? Can the legislature use its own collective wisdom to make that distinction under the rational basis standard?
Your Honor, no. I believe that the same research or what was available was presented to the legislature when deciding to adopt Senate Bill 10. So in order to be determined unconstitutional, it has to be shown by a reasonable doubt that it doesn't serve any legitimate or rational purpose. And I believe that given the overall scheme of the juvenile code as well as Senate Bill 10 and the former Megan's Law, holding those individuals more responsible and accountable for their actions at age 16 is certainly legitimate.
Could I ask it a different way? Was there anything in the statute that said the General Assembly was relying on specific studies to draw the line between the 15 and the 16-year-old? I mean, we know that lines don't have to be precisely drawn for to withstand an equal protection challenge. But here, what we're looking for is, was there anything the General Assembly had to say, this is why we're making the distinction where we're making it?
There was nothing in there specifically with respect to 16-year-olds. The General Assembly simply said that we find that certain offenders pose more of a risk than other offenders.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Powell, you have 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I first want to address what the studies do say. And there are a number of studies that address juvenile sex offending. And I think what the studies, if one reads the studies, I think what would strike a person is that it's not what we think. Particularly, children who start offending younger tend to recidivate more than children who offend when they're older. That's what the Caldwell study tells us. Interestingly, older children who offend on very young victims tend to have a less likelihood of recidivating than children who offend on same age level peers. That shocked me. So we think of adults who prey on very young children as being very, very dangerous. For children are different. And when children offend on young children, they tend not to commit offenses after that. Again, they tend to conform their sexual behavior because they're so sculptable, I guess, at that point, that they can change their behavior. I also want to address that, historically speaking, juvenile court has provided a shield and keeps juvenile adjudications buried in the graveyard of the forgotten past. But I think part of the schizophrenia that the Chief Justice was referring to is because we have this tension between what we typically have considered the juvenile court and what we believe to be the truth about sex offenders. Now, the schizophrenia, it's true. The public can't be informed in the same way of a sex offender if the sex offender's a juvenile. But sheriffs can monitor those those kids, and as they become adults, can monitor their behavior.
So you're not arguing that, that we should put this on the internet? That would make it more rational.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. And I don't think anybody would ever think that I would argue that. Quite the opposite, actually. I think the system makes more sense if juveniles are juveniles and adults are adults and never the twain shall meet.
So, Ms. Powell, in terms of the distinction between the 15-year-old and the 16-year-old, are you saying that that distinction in and of itself is irrational and can't be supported under an equal protection analysis? Or did the General Assembly have to at least mention what studies it was relying on to save it from this challenge of equal protection?
Now, this is a very difficult standard, and they don't have to show that anything that they did was rational.
So they could rely on common knowledge, even if that common knowledge is not correct?
They could. But again, when this court looks at the Kennedy-Mendoza factors, looks at whether the scope exceeds the purpose, I think it's easier to see that falls apart. If there was any rationale, it was wrong, and it can't withstand constitutional scrutiny. I also want to talk about the schizophrenia. There are states that put children of any age on the public registry. And so Ohio was out front with SORNA. Ohio was out front in passing Senate Bill 10. But I think that the legislature in the state understood that having children as young as 10 on a registry makes them susceptible to adults who can just see where they live and go prey on those young sexualized children. That's a bad idea. So I think there have to be lines. Again, I would draw the line at juvenile court jurisdiction, which is 21, unless the child is transferred to the adult system. Juveniles offend at a very low rate. And so the court has, Mr. Rowland said over and over again that Justin would have been the lowest level offender under old law. That's only because he would have been required to be an offender registrant. It didn't. This law under old law or new law doesn't give the court the opportunity to say he is not among the 4 to 10% that are likely to be dangerous as he goes forward. The court wasn't given the opportunity to look at his treatment and see if he is in that very slim group of people. Over-including kids based on age dilutes the registry, and it keeps the public from being able to be informed about who's dangerous and who's not. That's neither rational nor legitimate.
Can a court make a determination as to whether somebody's going to recidivate on a fine line?
It's difficult, and I think that courts would be more likely to err on the side of let's keep track of them until the 2152-84 hearing, which is, you know, parole can monitor them until then. I think a court would be more likely to err on the side of that. But I think this structure has also created this false belief that sex offenders need to be on a registry and that children need to be on a registry.
There could be a way to determine whether anybody would recidivate, any particular individual would recidivate. That would resolve a lot of issues in the criminal justice system, wouldn't it?
It would. There are tools available to calculate risk. Those tools are, we don't have as much science as we'd like.
Guidelines.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next case, 10-1027, WCI Steel versus William Wilkins, Tax Commissioner. Mr. Hilkert.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, my name is David Hilkert, and I am here on behalf of the taxpayer, WCI Steel. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves a detailed notice of appeal of 4 pages in length. So you might ask yourself, why are we here? The tax commissioner argues that WCI only alleged that the commissioner's valuation determination was not based on evidence and is contrary to law. He makes this argument at page 3 of his merit brief. That is a mischaracterization of the notice of appeal. The notice of appeal in this case not only set forth the 18 types of personal property that were improperly valued, but it also explained, for example, in assignment of error number 2, 1, what the tax commissioner did. In this case, he mechanically applied his 302 computation. In the very next sentence, 2, it explains what the tax commissioner should have done. He should have valued the property at fair market value, just as the WCI did in its response. And 3, it explained by reference to the Ohio Administrative Code the legal basis that dictated that the tax commissioner should have deviated from the 302 tables. He should have deviated because clearly, and it is directly in the Administrative Code section cited, the result was unjust and unreasonable because the fair market evaluation was approximately $30 million, whereas the tables, when applied to this antiquated equipment, resulted in a valuation of $120 million. Obviously, that's a significant difference, indicating an unjust or unreasonable result, and that dictates that the commissioner should have followed. In this case, the 4-page notice of appeal was filed in 2005. In 2007, this case was assigned for evidentiary hearing and was tried fully on the merits with all of the witnesses. At that hearing, at no time did the tax commissioner ever suggest that there was a defect in the notice, or that he didn't understand the issues, the valuation issue that the board was about to determine. At no time did he ever suggest that there was a lack of specificity in the notice, or that he needed some other information from the notice. The case was heard on the merits, and then the parties were assigned the task of filing 2 complete reply briefs with all of their positions.
Mr. Hilkert, is this because of Ohio Bell Telephone, because of that case which talked about the specificity of a notice that the taxpayer needs to present to the board?
I think it resulted because of, it shouldn't have, but I think it that became a factor which was taken out of context, and that's why later, as you'll find out, they tried to pigeonhole this case and tried to say the facts in this case were identical to the facts in Ohio Bell when they were not, so that they could get a dismissal.
We have an amicus brief from the State Bar Association suggesting that Ohio Bell has been interpreted to really require a taxpayer to almost lay out a case in the complaint or the notice before jurisdiction is accepted. Have you seen that yourself?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that we simply need to clarify that there's a misreading of Ohio Bell, that the notice of appeal, the specificity, relates to the errors. You simply need to say there's an error. Here we said the error is the mechanical application of the 302 formula. We said that the taxpayer had indicated to the fair market value the proper way to do it was $30 million, and we said the legal basis for when we cited to the Ohio Administrative Rule, right in the same notice of assignment of error number 2, we said, here's why in your own rules it says you should not have mechanically applied this. That clearly gives him notice of what our position was. That clearly distinguishes the case from Ohio Bell. Because Ohio Bell came up, what they tried to do is suggest that we changed our position because we simply changed the expert. But from the beginning, we challenged the valuation because it wasn't based on fair market value. It was simply historical cost from a depreciation schedule on obsolete and antiquated equipment. Their response was, well, you can go into secondary market, niche markets, and you claim in some advertising you do. But the fact of the matter is, we couldn't even compete. We could not do for the auto industry, though you had to have, we couldn't do the, they, each roll had to be 1,000 pounds to compete. Ours could not get there. Our equipment was completely antiquated. They had before them an appraisal-based report from Nationwide. Now, there'll be a dispute of how much they had, but they had an appraisal-based report with the typical three-process cost, market, income approaches. It's the exact same approach that was used by the expert to testify. The only difference was actually our expert was $1.5 million higher. But they had all of that before them. But then they tried to say this was identical to Ohio Bell, a cost and service life case where they only attacked the meth cost and they changed. This was not.
So if we were to accept your position, what relief would you be requesting of this court? A remand?
Yes. All they need to do is decided on the merits. We spent 4 days and nobody said anything. All the witnesses were there. They heard all the evidence. Then they sat on it for a year and a half. Then Ohio Bell came out. All they need to do is decide it on the evidence that they had.
So no new hearing is required?
No, they've got all the exhibits. They've got the testimony. They have the witnesses. All they need to do is decide the case on the merits.
Counsel, you would agree that if there was a failure in the notice of appeal, even if they, is that waivable or is that jurisdictional and continues to be jurisdictional?
I believe it is jurisdictional. I am not certain if it's waivable in light of a recent opinion from this court dealing with the Ohio Consumer Council. But I don't think we ever need to get to that issue. But it is interesting. The board suggested it didn't have jurisdiction, and yet when it addressed assignments of error 1 and 3, it said they were waived. Well, you can't waive something if you didn't have the power to hear it in the first instance. They had jurisdiction. I think it's implicit in some of that. And I think even the Board of Tax Appeals, it almost apologetically, or it was saying, well, I got reversed before. It never explained why this notice of appeal was less than adequate. It just said, well, since Ohio Bell came out and apparently have done it in other cases, they're just dismissing cases.
So to you, what happened is Ohio Bell spooked the Board of Tax Appeals.
Yes.
And they thought we had slapped them down to a greater extent than you believe.
Right. I think Ohio Bell was a narrow decision. I think Ohio Bell is a narrow decision. Ohio Bell was, what happened to Ohio Bell? They said cost and service life. Then, and that was the approach that apparently had been taken. Then what happened in Ohio Bell is in the middle of the case, after they said only cost and service life, they got to the Board of Tax Appeals. A case came out on another utility, and then they changed their position and said, okay, we're not doing cost and service life anymore. We're doing a unit appraisal. That was completely different than the facts of this case. And Ohio Bell, I think, is a fact-specific case that dealt specifically with that cost and service life issue and the complete change of position that we did not have in this case. And I think the board overread and took, and without the context of what the court was saying, in the context of the factual situation that existed in Ohio Bell.
So, Mr. Hilkert, do we need to address Ohio Bell in this case and limit it to its facts? Is it necessary for us to do that or not?
I think you could do that, but this court also said again in Ohio Bell that the notices of appeal, and I think you could simply reemphasize what this court has said all along, the notices of appeal do not have to be hyper-technical. And you've said all along that you don't have to put in all of your pieces of evidence, write your final brief in your notice of appeal. These notices of appeals are getting 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages simply out of fear that somebody can second guess one word. It's almost like if you have an idea, you ought to write it 10 different ways and hope that one of the 10 ways gets stuck.
Mr. Hilkert, did anyone challenge that notice of appeal before the board?
In which case?
Your case.
No, never. What happened is, after Ohio Bell came out, The board simply issued a directive to address the issue of Ohio Bell.
I understand, but as I read Ohio Bell failed to confer jurisdiction on the BTA to consider its appraisal challenge because its notice of appeal failed to specify any error in the commissioner's final determination relating to that challenge. And that's the position the commissioner took in that case.
Yes, but he didn't take it.
But
he
didn't take that position here.
No.
So this
because
is
it did, and he knew it.
You're telling us this is a sua sponte surprise decision that you received from the Board of Tax Appeals on an issue that wasn't really litigated before the board.
Absolutely. It was after all the litigation was over and the case was had been briefs had been in for over a year and a half.
Where the tax commissioner never challenged the validity of your notice of appeal.
Nothing.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, we submit in this case, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time if there are no additional questions, that this court should simply, as it in cases has said, that the requirement is to specify error, not to set forth all of your evidence, it is not hyper-technical, and that in this case we clearly met the standard. We just didn't simply say this is contrary to law where you had no idea what it was.
Thank you. Mr. Hubbard?
May it please the court. I'd first like to point out that this case is actually much easier than Ohio Bell because with respect to the valuation challenge. And because if you look at their notice of appeal in this case, it's really, they say it's four pages. That includes the certificate of service. There's big blank spaces. It's really essentially two paragraphs. And a lot of it has to do not with the valuation challenge, but also they're making the argument that certain items of equipment were not used in business. And the reason that we didn't file a motion to dismiss earlier, we did file a motion to dismiss after Ohio Bell, the Supreme Court decision came out. Basically, the way this worked is the Board of Tax Appeals, when there is a potentially valid issue, doesn't entertain partial motions to dismiss. And they did actually have a valid claim that they specified. It had to do with whether a certain arc transformer was used in business. So in the past, what I've done, and of course, you know, I've represented the tax commissioner for over 25 years. We've moved for partial dismissal, and the board says we're not going to grant a partial dismissal so long as there's a viable issue still pending. What they did with respect to the arc transformer issue is they never presented it to the board at the evidentiary hearing. They waived that, and that's what the board's decision in this case recognizes. So, Justice O'Donnell, the reason we didn't file a motion to dismiss at that earlier point before the actual hearing was because they had a potentially viable issue still there. And the second reason is, and this has to do with the board.
Well, at the time it was filed, you said that they had a potentially viable issue?
They did, but not with respect to the valuation challenge, with respect to whether certain other property was used in business and therefore subject to tax. In other words, it was their claim.
Why wouldn't
the
board go ahead and decide that then if it's a viable issue?
They didn't present that issue, and the board held that they abandoned it, and they haven't appealed that here. So there's no reason, just as in Ohio Bell, the valuation challenge that was raised before the commissioner was raised in their notice of appeal to the board, they abandoned. And so because they abandoned that valuation challenge, this court dismissed the entire case.
But if I understand his claim, the appeal to the Board of Tax Appeals was based on evaluation of a lot of equipment, which
they
said was functionally obsolete.
That's right.
And the notice of appeal didn't tell the Board of Tax Appeals that was their argument?
What they said, Your Honor, was the same thing they said in Ohio Bell. The general catch on Ohio Bell, the taxpayer identified a specific valuation approach, evaluation claim. In Ohio Bell, it was you should use replacement cost new for all the plant property and then apply economic and functional obsolescence to that. They had presented a study at the commissioner's level, Ohio Bell did, and they had preserved that issue on appeal to the board. But they then wanted to change their valuation challenge dramatically to a unit value approach, and this court said that wasn't raised because what they were relying on was exactly the same language that's here. In Ohio Bell, they had a general catch-all that said the commissioner's valuation was an overvaluation and didn't reflect true value. That's all they're saying here. If you look at their notice of appeal.
But they didn't change their type of valuation like Ohio Bell did.
Right. In fact, they didn't set forth anything, Your Honor.
Well,
in other words,
I dissented in Ohio Bell,
yes,
and I presaged what seems to be happening. Are you seeing the Court of Appeals dismissing a lot of these cases now based
on the BTA?
Ohio Bell? I mean, the BTA.
No, actually, this is the only case. In fact, basically, what's happening here, Your Honor, and this is much worse than what happened, because what they did at the tax commissioner's level is they submitted a comparative cost approach in-house. It wasn't this nationwide appraisal they keep referring to. That was what they presented to the commissioner was a comfort of sales approach where they looked at various different plants.
Are you saying that in notices of appeal, you now have to also lay out how you intend to prove your evidence? Is
no,
that
what
you think Ohio Bell required?
No, Your Honor, what we're saying is you have to identify the challenge that you're making. There's so many different ways of valuing property, and they have distinct evidence and they have distinct analysis. You can have the commissioner's approach is an original acquisition cost less depreciation. And most taxpayers, when they're challenging the commissioner's determination, argue within that distinct methodology and say the commissioner applied his own methodology incorrectly. When we look at this notice of appeal, we don't know whether they're challenging the commissioner's methodology and say he just did it incorrectly, or they're trying to find a completely alternative methodology that relies on, for example, income or comparative sales.
Excuse me, do you believe Ohio Bell now requires you to lay out the method that
yes.
you're going to use to challenge? That's how you read Ohio Bell?
And in fact, in this case, if they wanted to rely on the methodologies in their valuation challenge that they had both below, they should have said that. They didn't even say that. They didn't say the commissioner erred in failing to use the methodology that we urged the commissioner to use below.
If you believe that Ohio Bell has not been misinterpreted, why are we having all these amicus briefs filed by the chamber and the state bar?
Well, I think, Your Honor, what they want to do is they're looking at it from a standpoint of course, they want to preserve the rights of their clients. But I would point this out. This court, in a most recent case, decided last month, really supported the specification of error requirement. There, it was a property tax challenge, a personal property tax challenge. And guess who the appellant was? It was the county auditor who was saying the commissioner had valued the property too low. And the commissioner and the taxpayer, actually, this happened in two cases. One where, but I'll talk the first one, Waste Management. Waste Management and the commissioner were co-appellees at the Ohio Supreme Court. The Board of Tax Appeals granted our motion to dismiss for failure to specify error on the part of the county auditor. The county auditor had done the exact same thing that WCIA has done here with respect to failing to specify error. The county auditor, though, said the valuation was too low and it was unreasonable. Whereas here, they're saying it's too high. Because, of course, the county auditor is representing the political subdivisions who receive the revenues, and, of course, they would want to get greater revenue. I've never known a taxpayer who, when they file an appeal, wouldn't want to have a lower valuation. So it's not a great revelation when their notice of appeal says the commissioner erred by overvaluing the property. And if you look at their notice of appeal, it's virtually identical to the one in Queen City Valve. Queen City Valve is a case that was decided in 1954, and it was the seminal specification of error case. And what it said is a notice of appeal that says the commissioner's determination is, quote, excessive and contrary to law and not based on evidence is too general. It doesn't fit the requirements of the specification of error.
Mr. Hubbard, let me ask you what the purpose of the notice of appeal is for the commission.
It's twofold, Your Honor.
We're talking about error charged being specified in the notice of appeal. That's what we said in
yes.
Bell in paragraph 30, that the error must be specified. So that, what is the purpose?
The purpose of it is to put the board and the commissioner on notice of what the valuation challenge is. And there's distinct analysis and evidence for each different kind of approach to value. There are many different kinds of valuation methodologies other than the commissioner's. So it puts the commissioner on notice. And also, because if you're raising a new valuation challenge that wasn't the subject of the commissioner's final determination, that it can't be a new issue. This is what court said that in American Fiber System, recently affirmed that in the Delaney versus Testa case I was referring to last month. And so it's two things. If it requires that it be a specification of error in the commissioner's final determination. So the commissioner had to have addressed the issue. And when you have a totally new valuation approach, which is what they argued at the Board of Tax Appeals, then the commissioner has not addressed that issue. And so you're bypassing the commissioner's expertise and knowledge and discretion. The commissioner is a statewide tax assessor and assesses business property in all 88 counties. There needs to be a uniformity to that, and it's the fact the commissioner reviews it first, and then his findings are presumptively valid. They must be shown to be clearly unreasonable or unlawful. And in this case, they completely bypass that. There weren't any findings of the commissioner on the appraisal.
The issue of notice, basically, the notice of appeal, the issues that are going to be at issue on appeal. Is there any procedural mechanism that can be used similar to criminal cases where you have the indictment, let's say, the state needs to, or the defense needs to know more information and can file a bill of particulars saying, straighten this out, tell us what you really mean. Is there any similar mechanism that
sure.
the commission
I mean,
can
the
say?
The fact is we could do that, but again, this is an appellate review, the Board of Tax Appeals. So it's not like this is the first opportunity to present information. We had detailed reviews by the auditors of the commissioner on this, and the commissioner's final determination is a detailed review. If you look at the statutory transcript in this case of what the commissioner considered, it's hundreds of pages.
Counsel, appellant's brief, they set forth the guts of the notice of appeal, and it appears to me that it's paragraph 2 that we're quarreling about here. And help us understand this. If I get what they're saying is that when they submitted their tax returns, they claimed the total value of the property in dispute was $30 million. And the tax commissioner found it to be what?
We found it to be for various years, but for one of the years it was about $120 million. Of course,
right.
The bankruptcy court, for a few years later, found it to be $196 million.
All right.
So we're well under what the bankruptcy court argued. And
is that in the
record?
It's
about six times what they were arguing.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the right. 196 is actually... It's also, we had to file a detailed Board of Tax
right,
Appeals brief
right.
on the merits
but,
of this.
Well, let me stick to the notice of appeal. So they filed a tax return, and they say in the notice of appeal, we filed a tax return saying all this property is worth $30 million. And then in paragraph 2, they say determination by the tax commissioner reflects property being valued at a percentage of its original cost. So they're saying the tax commissioner rejected that and used the standard original cost minus the...
They rejected what, Your Honor?
Rejected what they put down on the tax.
They don't say that. They don't reference the valuation, the dollar amount they reference.
Right.
They say it's no more than $30 million.
But they say the tax commissioner reflects property be valued the percentage of its original cost using the tax commissioner's composite annual allowance procedure. And then they say the true value of the taxpayer's personal property included the determination that is not more than these values identified above as asserted in the taxpayer's applications for final assessment. So
right.
they essentially say that's what we're appealing. You say it's one thing.
They say it's too high. That's what they're saying.
We say it is this number. Based on the specifics and the methodology that they used to submit their tax return. And that's what's in dispute. So what more does the...
Basically, their tax return just asserted a value. They didn't attach anything to that, okay? I mean, basically, they asserted, they followed our methodology, and then they claimed a deduction from book value and said it's $30 million. And then subsequent to that, they
submitted... In just one lump sum, or did they go machine by machine by machine in their tax return?
Basically, the true value computation is a composite annual allowance. I mean, it's composite-based, so it's kinds of machinery, but it's all their production machinery was classified at a certain rate.
Okay, so... But
they basically, they if say you look at Ohio Bell, they
what
just
we're
said
appealing
the same thing.
Is you valued it one way, we valued it on our tax return another way, and that's the dispute that we're asking the Board of Tax Appeals to resolve.
And that's about as broad as you possibly could have. Essentially, if you say it's too high and you don't say why, and we've had this discussion in Ohio Bell, that's the most broad you could possibly have. They did not even incorporate in their notice of appeal the valuation challenge that they made to the commissioner. They were trying to keep their powder dry to the nth degree. If there cannot be a more general allegation than to say your plan
at
assets
stage,
are
at what right. stage would their secret computation method be revealed?
Yeah, that's right. We don't know. I'm sorry, at what
at
stage?
At what stage? I mean, you say it's not in the appeal because they're trying to keep their powder dry. When would they have disclosed the computation?
At the Board of Tax Appeals, that's what they did. And it was only then that they disclosed it. It was radically different from what they had presented to the commissioner.
And how did that impact, the state?
Well, basically what happened at that point is it was by surprise. I mean, they actually just created an entirely different, radically different approach to value. They took replacement cost new and applied economic obsolescence to that, which wasn't anything like what they had presented to the commissioner.
That's a totally different valuation methodology
yes.
that they used on the appeal than what they used under...
Yeah, so that's just like Ohio Bell. But
okay, wait a second.
I'm sorry?
But they came out with the same number.
No, they didn't. No, their value at the BTA was about... over twice what they argued at the commissioner's level. They had a completely different valuation
for
all
but,
3 years.
At the commissioner's level, it still was less than what...
It was less than what we assessed.
What you assessed.
They were arguing $30 million. Then at the Board of Tax Appeals, there were 3 years involved. Each year was different, but they were between $40 and $85 million for those 3 years. So it varied, but it was totally different.
Because they accepted some of the... Maybe they accepted some of the evidence that you had at the lower
trials. No, it had nothing to do with our true value computation, Your Honor. We basically applied the prescribed method, which is based on original acquisition cost. They didn't use original acquisition cost and then make adjustments from there. Instead, they looked at replacement cost new. This for the vast majority of their assets, they did this. And then for certain other ones, they looked at what the comparative sales would be in the market.
And all that evidence the Board of Tax Appeals could have looked at and weighed against your evidence and made a decision.
Well, basically what they did, let's put this in another context. Suppose somebody says, we don't think our property is subject to tax, it's exempt. But they don't say why. They just say it's exempt. And there are like 200 exemptions. You wouldn't say they specified error if they didn't set forth the exemptions. But we don't
have to. Mr. Hubbard, in this case, Justice Pfeiffer has taken you through an allegation in the notice of appeal.
Yes, and
it was with respect to a certain valuation of property.
Yes,
the board concluded, if I'm reading it correctly, with respect to the specification of error 2 and 4, which was an allegation that this was contrary to law. We find them to be so broad and vague as to be insufficient to invoke jurisdiction.
Yes.
You don't think that contesting the valuation with one number or another is sufficient to invoke the
Absolutely
jurisdiction?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, because the theory of valuation is that they're just saying it's overvalued. They're not saying you should have used an income approach.
Excuse me. You want to have a methodology specified? Is that what you're saying?
It's an approach to yes.
Well, that isn't what Ohio Bell said.
Well, actually,
the tax commissioner argued in Ohio Bell that Ohio Bell failed to confer jurisdiction to the BTA to consider its appraisal based on a challenge because Ohio Bell's notice of appeal failed to specify any error in the commissioner's final determination relating to the appraisal challenge.
Okay.
Here there was a contest.
No, they were, Your Honor, actually in Ohio Bell, if you look at it, the language that was looked at by the court said the commissioner's true value computation did not reflect true value. It overvalued the property. That's exactly what they're claiming here. Ohio Bell, the language in Ohio Bell that you held was too general, was exactly the same language that they're saying here, except they've added that it's contrary to law and it's not supported by evidence. And we know that a general allegation that something's contrary to law and not supported by evidence is too general.
Mr. Hubbard.
If we look at Ohio Bell, the language in Ohio Bell that this court looked at that said was too general was exactly the same language as here.
Mr. Hubbard, before you sit down, take us through the mechanics of what happens. Taxpayer files this return saying our property is worth $30 million. The tax commissioner makes a determination that it's worth $150 or whatever.
Right.
Now, that the tax commissioner, somebody at the tax commissioner's office does something, I don't know whether you call it an audit or
yes, what. Yes, that's exactly what happens.
And in that audit, do they go out to the plant
yes.
and kick the tires and sit
well,
down with them?
In some instances they do. In
or,
this case,
or do they do it at a computer at their desk? So,
in this case, Your Honor, there was a detailed field audit done. And you see the field audit. It's in our supplement.
Right.
It's in the statutory transcript. Detailed. Findings of the commissioner.
All right, but what I'm getting at, then there is an exchange of information, and the commissioner or the person representing the commissioner knows the basis on which they're saying.
Yes, and they changed that dramatically at the Board of Tax Appeals. We rejected their we made findings, very specific findings as to why the methodology they presented to, the approach they presented to us in that audit was wrong. We made those findings. They didn't contest those findings. You know, they had a burden of contesting those findings. Our findings are, this court has said at least 40 times that the commissioner's findings are presumptively valid and must be shown to be clearly unreasonable and unlawful. They did not contest those findings. One of the principal findings was that their comparable sales, they were looking at all these other plants, and they're all integrated steel producers. They're not. They're a specialty niche producer. And we said, you can't look at the comparable sales of these others, of these other plants. You look at the subject property, and it's so much different. And that was a principal reason. Another principal reason in our findings was we looked at the bankruptcy proceedings. The bankruptcy court had rejected this appraisal that they're now saying they presented to the commissioner, the nationwide appraisal. That wasn't presented to the commissioner. That was for a year later in the whole process. It was as of a different valuation date, 4 years from the first valuation date here. It was for $83 million, and they didn't give us any of the underlying. All they did is a conclusion of value. They didn't provide us with what
Thank
that
you.
Methodology was.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard.
Thank you.
Mr. Hilkert. Pardon me?
You'll take a look in the appellee's own supplement when he says we didn't give it to him. Look at pages 71 to 88. There's a total report right here, and it says income. It says we used cost, income. We used the three methods. You look at what he says about what they got in the audit. It's in the supplement, page 203. They admit the appraiser, with their adjuster, cheating, go out and look at anything. But if you look at 10, they say they had this appraisal, and the appraisal considered the following approaches in arriving at indicators of value: cost, market, and income. It's at page 203 of the supplement.
Mr. Hilkert, in the board's
In
the board's determination, they indicated that specification of errors 1 and 3 appear to have been abandoned.
There was evidence in the briefs on those items when we just briefed that issue. In other words,
you just briefed it. You didn't argue it before the board.
Well, no, we had it. can I back up, Judge?
I just need an answer to the abandonment claim.
We did put in evidence in 2007. When the board asked us to just address the jurisdictional issue in 2010, we didn't specifically at that time address the evidence that we presented on those items. So we did not go back and cite any evidence. The board made that determination. I think there was that record. I would also say this. He says what he did and didn't do at the board level. He didn't file a partial motion. He wasn't the attorney of record.
I'm not understanding your answer. Did you abandon the positions you claimed in 1 and 3? And are we here, as Justice Pfeiffer points out, on assignment of it?
Primarily on 2. I believe on 1 and 3 there was some evidence, but we did not brief that in response to the board's directive.
So this is all about the specification. And
the specificity is the issue.
2.
Yes. We are here on specificity.
So, counsel, can you tell me what error is being asserted?
The error in this case,
or two.
The error is that the 302 computation was mechanically applied that resulted in a valuation of almost 120, that the proper method was what the taxpayer did, which with the evidence he gave them, which resulted in a valuation of $30 million, and that the statutory basis for making the determination to deviate from the tables was in the administrative rule, which is cited again in assignment of error number 2, because the result was unjust or unreasonable. And that language is specifically in the administrative rule that we cited that shows the basis and why the tax commissioner should have accepted our evaluation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, would you announce?